left, right, or in between, you've come to the right place. It's time to talk. This is The Advocates. 4 full hours of opinion, discussion, insightful guests, and your calls at 524-6288. The Advocates, on the air at 1350 AM and online at WEZS.com. Now, here's your host, Neil Young.
Yes, we are. We returned with Ken Gorell, who did not go out for another coffee. And Representative Paul Hofgarten retired. And William, you can call me Bill Smith of conservativeblogger.com. And for those of you who aren't quite sure who I am, my name is Jose Jimenez.
Wow.
Baseball been very, very good to me. Anyway, I'm losing my marbles. This has been, I called Betty, what was it, the last break in the 10 to 11 hour. And it is true. I have to say this. And it's not me. It's the people I put around me, the great callers. And this program is the fastest 4 hours in radio. I know we could do 5. It's not going to happen. But we have great guests. We've got a lot of good conversation. And so I guess I'm sort of giving my Christmas ending now as the hour begins. But it's the people I put around me who make the program, the listeners, the sponsors. Please see the sponsors. And remember that Howie Chandler really wants you to call him about the Meredith Bay Colony Club at 279-0080. And not that other darn number I have in the ad, which he gave me. But anyway, so maybe we'll get a little chance for a little Christmas discussion near the end. We are going to have a guest in a few minutes, we hope. If not, we'll discuss his book. What the heck? We know all about that. We just didn't write 300 pages of it. Okay, you know who's here, and we all plan to be here when we return after this break.
Free carpet installation. Free carpet installation. Free carpet installation. Yes, you heard that right. Hi, this is Bruce from The Home Beautiful, here to tell you that from now through December, all carpets in the store selling for $1.99 per square foot or more will be installed for free. That's right. No jokes, no gimmicks. Simply purchase a minimum of 25 square yards of carpet and pad, and basic installation labor is free. This unheard-of offer is available only at The Home Beautiful now through December. So if you've been thinking about replacing those worn-out floors, now is truly the time to act. Plus, if you're thinking about ceramic tile, then you'll want to take advantage of our December sale. You'll save 25% off. That's right, 25% off every tile in our showroom. These incredible deals are available only from The Home Beautiful and The Flooring Network. The Home Beautiful, Route 3 Laconia, where you always get the best service, best price, best advice, and qualified buyers enjoy 1 year, no payment, no interest financing.
While not a pleasant topic, it's one your family may someday have to deal with. And careful pre-arranging of your funeral plans can greatly ease the burden on those you leave behind.
At Wilkins & Bean, pre-arranging ensures all your wishes will be honored and taken care of for you, an aging parent, a grandparent, or loved one.
And by knowing all the choices available and pre-arranging them now, you'll make it easier and less stressful than during a time of sorrow. Pre-arrangement of your wishes and the wishes of those close to you avoids unwanted confusion, saves time and money, and provides peace of mind.
Relieve the emotional and financial burden from those you love by pre-planning with Wilkins & Bean Funeral Home. For more information, visit online at wilkinsandbean.com.
Pre-arranging, it helps in so many ways.
Wilkins & Bean Funeral Home and Cremation Services, 164 Pleasant Street, Laconia, for when details matter.
We've been your local bank for 176 years, longer than any New Hampshire bank. Our mission is helping individuals and businesses succeed and enhancing the quality of life in New Hampshire. We provide local decision-making, personal service, and the latest technology. We strengthen our communities throughout New Hampshire through volunteerism and financial resources. We are living, working, and growing together. We know what New Hampshire is all about. We are Laconia Savings Bank. We are New Hampshire's local bank.
We return to the airwaves here. My name is Neil Young. The program is called The Advocates, here every Saturday morning at WEZS 1350 AM, 8 until noon, and on the internet, WEZS.com, and the podcast. You can pick it up for the parts that you miss. You can get it throughout the week. so you don't miss a thing. Ken Gorell is with me. Representative Paul Hofgarten is here. William Smith of conservativeblogger.com. And I'm Neil Young. And here, the great news is we have James Kalb as our guest. James, good morning.
Good morning.
And Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
We, the four of us in the studio right now, because my program's a little different from a lot of them. I'm not a Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck, although I like all three of them. My idea is to have a round table, so there's a lot of voices, and I'm not just telling people how to think. I bring in people who tell me how they think, and then I tell them if they're right or wrong. Your book, The Tyranny of Liberalism, I love it. Because we must, all I have to do is look at the cover and know we've got to be on the same page politically. Understanding and Overcoming Administered Freedom, Inquisitorial Tolerance, and Equality by Command, James Kalb. Wow. That is, with the new president coming in, we're all quite concerned on where the country is going to go. You and I are probably the two oldest people in the room, and you're not even here. But you're a Dartmouth man.
That's right, yes.
Well, that's good. I was talking to a Dartmouth man the other night, and he wanted to know what year, what class you were, because he would have probably been in the early or mid-60s.
Yeah, I was in the late 60s, like class of 69.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, I'll pass that along to him. But anyway, James, this is you've been described as a scholar, an attorney, and, of course, an author. What do you mean by administered freedom?
Yeah, liberalism is an odd thing because it starts with this idea of freedom. That's what it says. It's really the highest goal of law, of everything, of how people should deal with each other. And then it starts off as a critical approach to government. That says, well, gee, you should rein in the power of the king, and you should get rid of inherited privileges like the nobility have, and do something about the established church. So it's a critic of power. But then you have to ask what happens, and if this approach, which is a single-minded critique of power, becomes the government. Because then it no longer is a critic of government, because it is the government. And if it criticized itself, then it would be criticizing the principle of equal freedom. So it tends rather to promote the extension of government power. And instead it looks around and says, gee, what are the other social powers? And it turns out that everything is a social power because, a big company and employer is obviously a social power. But so are all of us in daily life. Because all of us have effects on other people. If you walk down the street and you look at somebody funny, then you're helping to set up the situation in which he lives. And so you are exerting social power. So in order to carry out its single-minded goal, which is equal freedom, it has to control what everybody does. It has to control how people speak to each other, how they think about each other, what their attitudes are. It has to take a look at places of employment and says, well, we can't have environments that are characterized by harassment, where harassment comes to include anything that puts some people on a different footing from other people. In order to bring that about, you have to completely retrain everybody constantly and supervise what they say and how they communicate with each other, what jokes they make, and so on. And so that's what administered freedom is. It's the idea that in order to be free, we have to be free in all the connections of our lives, and in order to have that, we have to have the structure to supervise everybody's connection with anybody else, and to say just what it should be.
James, we've had one caller today already challenge me on when I refer to the government schools, because I refuse to call them the public schools, because we have very little to say about what goes on within the walls. We're just expected to fund the buildings, fund the educators, fund the administration, in other words, keep your mouth shut. And let us do, we'll handle the social engineering on this end and the revision of history. And I'm really concerned about my country. I have 10 grandchildren, and I've strived to make sure that my country is the way I found it when I got here, and I want to leave it that way for them. Now, we know that's not going to happen. But now, with this recent election of Barack Obama, What does his win? That's why I knew we could have a great conversation here, but I was challenged earlier on school choice. I happen to be a big school choice fan, and I was challenged on what happens within the walls of the schools. But now with our new president, what does an Obama's Barack Obama win mean for the spread of liberalism?
Well, he's kind of a symbol of the spread of liberalism. The conservatives have had various issues with the Bush administration. Some of us have thought that, for example, the tendency to nationalize education or to sort of expand the role of government was not so great. But still, the Republicans, in many ways, act as a kind of a barrier to the advance of the sort of thing we've been talking about, the social engineering, administered freedom, trying to interfere with all the connections of life to make everybody free in all respects, equally free. And, Obama's on one side, and the Democratic Party, the main dominant group in the Democratic Party, are on one side, and so their victory on the side favoring that, and so their victory obviously removes a barrier to the advance of that particular approach to things. I don't think Obama himself is going to be like particularly radical by the standards of the Democratic Party. He seems to be bringing in people who within that party are viewed as mainstream established figures. But the basic tendency is there, and a barrier has disappeared, and so I think we'll be seeing some movement that's built up and that has been thwarted.
Ken Durrell.
Good morning, sir. My name is Ken, and one of the quotes you have from write about in The Tyranny of Liberalism is about political correctness and how it's possible to establish these authoritative moral views that are at odds with what you call long-established understandings, I guess it's traditions. And one of the ongoing discussions I have with a liberal friend of mine, and I do have a few, is how bad tradition is. You tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater when we talk about tradition. And, of course, they bring up slavery is the easy one, and they bring up a few other traditions that are bad, without seeming to understand that most of our traditions that have been built up over the course of decades, centuries, millennia, are actually very good. Can you talk a little bit about the political correctness and how it's been undermining these traditions?
Yeah, well, in principle, the liberal approach is anti-tradition because they want to take a simple principle, equal freedom, and make that the standard for everything. And so they really can't... Tradition is a matter of people in their daily lives coming to develop certain habits and dealing with each other, and those habits establish themselves and becoming something that people attach themselves to and regard as something that makes the world what it is and the natural way for things to be. And the advantage of that approach is that it sort of sweeps in all sorts of considerations that are kind of hard to think of, that don't occur to you until you don't pay any attention to it and there are problems, but pays attention to that sort of thing and pays attention to how things work out in practice, because something doesn't become traditional unless it works mostly for most of the people involved, and so they come to do it as a matter of second nature. Now, the liberals don't like that because it makes everything kind of unclear just what the justification is for things. And they like to have clear justifications to see whether what's going on is really justifiable. And in order to have such a system, they have to have somebody who can look from above at what everybody's doing and apply clear standards to it. That's how you get the growth of bureaucracy and the growth of political correctness and of various re-education initiatives. Yeah, because they're trying to bring what everybody does into line with sort of abstract, clear principles that are supposed to be just. And so in that kind of system, there's no place for tradition, because tradition is not administered. It's not fully understood. You can't know exactly what it's all about. And it's just something people do. And so you can't tell whether it's justified or not, and often it doesn't look justified. So just as a matter of basic structure, liberalism is going to be anti-traditional.
You also talk about the stealth quality of liberalism and the fact that that gives liberalism an advantage in public discussion. Can you talk a little bit more about that, the stealth quality?
Okay, sure. Because the principle really is equal freedom. And so then it becomes hard to accuse it of tyranny because, after all, they really are attached to freedom. And if you point to anything like political correctness, you say, that's just doing something about the unexamined tyrannies of daily life. And so how can you complain about that? What kind of person are you? So it works by taking commonly accepted goals like equality of freedom and freedom and making them sort of self-contained so that they don't take notice of common sense or how things actually work out, and then enforcing them by some sort of structure that can't be supervised by anybody outside the structure. But it's still officially and even based on some arguments, freedom. And so it does have a stealth quality. The terms that we're used to, like tolerance and mutual respect, by becoming absolute and by becoming something that gets enforced by this external structure, completely change their nature, but they still retain enough of the original content. So it's kind of hard to make the argument as easily as other arguments.
One of the common topics on this show has been education. We certainly talked about it this morning, and then even yelled about it this morning. And I think a lot of what you're talking about is an unexamined life quality that I think is happening in our schools. I see kids not thinking about how they should examine, how they should truly question the things around them, because they are simply a dogmatic approach. And of course, the irony is that many of the educators today and the people who have shaped our public, or as Neil says, government schools, are from the radical generation where they want to question everything, and yet they've produced a system that is putting out products, kids in this case, with high school diplomas that don't mean a whole heck of a lot, that have uninquisitive minds, unless it's how to get to the next level of some video game. Is that also part of this tyranny of liberalism?
Well, yeah, because, again, the idea is that everything's based on... The idea really is that everything's based not only on freedom, but on investigation and on intelligence and on figuring out how things are. But the idea is that, well, let's do that in a serious way, they say. So let's have the experts do it. Because if you're specially trained, obviously you can ask the right questions, you can sort through the various answers and look at it from the whole perspective, and so you'll come to the right conclusions. But then if it's the experts who are especially able to do that, then the role of each lay individual becomes accepting what he's told and going with it. I mean, if you don't do what you're told, that's it, you resist change, and that's like a psychological problem. And you're just sort of clinging out of bitterness to something that the experts have determined does not make sense.
Your use of the term psychological disorder rings bells, of course, with the Soviet era, where dissidents were put in mental institutions because you could only be mentally imbalanced if you could possibly dissent against the great Soviet march forward.
Yeah, but that's the problem with the systems of social engineering, where they claim that, look, we've got this principle that explains how people should relate to each other and what life should be about. Then if you think the result stinks, obviously you're misinterpreting things, and because the experts have looked at it and they've said how it should be, and they're right. They must be right. How can you disagree with them? Do you have superior knowledge to the experts? So that... your views must be based on some sort of disorder. Either you're just ignorant, in which case you get re-educated, or if you're stubborn in it, there's something wrong with you. I mean, with how you form your opinions, and it's a psychological problem.
It's interesting, James Kyle, author of The Tyranny of Liberalism, Understanding and Overcoming Administered Freedom, Inquisitorial Tolerance, and Equality by Command. James is the author of this book, and I know you talk about the Taliban here and the tolerance, and it, the liberals today keep telling us how they want me as a conservative, a traditionalist, they want the, how they want me to keep my mouth shut about certain issues, yet they don't understand that the people who have been trying to kill us since 9/11, well, for probably for
1993
years,
at least,
yes. that if they were to come into power, the liberals really wouldn't like them.
One aspect of taking this completely rational system as an ideal and thinking that, well, you know, we're really smart so we can bring it about, is that they tend to lose their grip on reality, because they want to think that, well, gee, the world really can be made by taking a simple principle, equal freedom, and having ever more complex system of regulation that brings it about. And that kind of approach does not have any place for fundamental conflicts. You know, it assumes that everybody's pretty much alike, and if somebody thinks that people aren't like them, there's something wrong with them, and he has to be re-educated. And so it has a very hard time recognizing, you know, basic differences. Because we saw that sometimes in the president's rhetoric and preceding the war in Iraq, that every Iraqi parent wants his kids to have democracy and prosperity, so therefore we just go there and everybody will cheer and it'll turn into Wisconsin or something. so they have a hard time seeing that there are basic conflicts that can't be explained away. And that force is a basic element in any in the continuance of any social arrangement. So that if you have something like the radical Islam that you have to deal with, they want to say, well, this is all a big misunderstanding. You know, it's because these fundamentalists and backwoodsmen misinterpret the religion of peace as something other than just the restatement of the same beliefs that liberals have. And that's, they have a hard time thinking about things in any other way, because if the world were different from that, they'd have a much less of an outlook, they're much less of a prospect of establishing the system they want.
One of our ongoing debates here, in addition to education policy, although within the room there's not much debate, we are pretty much in agreement, is, we mentioned his name before, and I guess we'll have to mention him again, Texas Representative
Ron Paul.
Ron Paul. conservatives, Republicans, libertarians. What is this libertarian beast? Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because there are times I wanted him to be normal, and I wanted to be able to vote for him. And I attended some political functions here during the primaries with Ron Paul supporters, and I mean, there may have been one normal guy there, but he was hiding. As I said, libertarianism attracts me for a number of reasons, and then suddenly they lose me at some point. How do they differ from modern liberalism?
Oh, okay, yeah. Philosophically, it's pretty close, because you like liberalism. They take this single, simple principle, basically, the same freedom, having the same freedom for everybody. They have the same basic principle. And, you know, the liberals take a sort of a more imaginative approach to bringing that out. They say, well, look, there's all these other interferences with freedom, and so therefore we need this huge structure that controls everything so that everybody will be equally free, because otherwise somebody will be put upon by somebody else. And the libertarians, of course, that's ridiculous. And they say, well, gee, let's have basically no structure at all, because any structure will obviously involve inequalities and the use of force to force people to do what they don't feel like doing. And instead of having a structure that somebody can run, we'll have structure based on property rights, where I own myself, so I can do anything I feel like, as long as I don't violate somebody else's property rights. And also, I own the property that I acquire by working or by trade or whatever the, I guess by making something or by trading. And so, like the liberals, they have a very simple and comprehensive theory of things based on everybody having the same freedom. And so, like the liberals, they leave out a lot of actual human life in coming up with their prescriptions for how things ought to be. And so that's why some of the things they say seem a bit odd from time to time. You know, a lot of them are interested in science fiction, for example, because it's sort of the construction of a world that is not the world that we live in. But of course, there's a lot. They have a great deal more in common with traditional American conservatism, because traditional American conservatism said that, well, look, you have a limited government because you know, first, as the libertarians say, it's not nice to force people to do things they don't like to do, but also you have limited government because traditions are good, and traditions are the things people work on their habitual way of acting day to day that they attach themselves to, and that becomes symbolically important in their lives. And so if you have less government, there's more room for the principle of tradition to operate. So I guess that's the difference. The you know, libertarians, like traditional conservatives, like to have limited government, but they have less of a notion that, well, there's going to be other social authorities like family and religion. Because those are the things that people attach themselves to and recognized as creating obligations. And the libertarians don't like to recognize obligations except those that are very simple and based on a single system of property rights.
That begs the question, what's the difference between libertarians and anarchists?
Sometimes there isn't a lot. I mean, within the libertarian movement, they have these debates, you know, there's anarcho-capitalism is one tendency in it, that they shouldn't have any state at all and no government at all. They should just have you contract with, like, the army who's going to protect you or something. And then there's the minarchists who recognize, well, you have to have a little bit of a government. I don't know exactly how big of one. You, maybe it's okay to have courts, or maybe it's okay to have an army or something. So, Yeah, in theory, there's not a huge difference, and some of the more consistent and radical libertarians are, in fact, anarchists.
The James, I'm just looking here at your bio. A lawyer and scholar whose essays on political thought have appeared widely in the U.S. and Europe, holds degrees from Dartmouth College and Yale University. Well, let me, it has nothing to do with your book, but Sarah Palin, you know why I think a lot of Americans liked her, including me, was because she was more like me. And when I see the John Kerrys, the George W. Bushes, and these other folks who have gone to Harvard or Yale, I sometimes think, goodness, that's why Sarah Palin was so attractive, is because she was like us, me.
Yeah, what the... Yeah, she seemed like more of a normal person, and the others, well, yeah, there's obviously a ruling class, and, you know, George W. Bush was obviously part of that. He looked at things from the perspective of somebody who runs things, rather than from the perspective of daily life and how people work things out among themselves in their local setting. And, you know, that's a very strong tendency in American life. We have, 200 million people and very big institutions, and so the people who run them are going to be people who are comfortable and accustomed to the environment at the top, which has a very different outlook on things. The biggest area in which you see an argument resulting from that, I think, is immigration, where the people at the top are all in favor of it. You know, they say that, well, gee, we got this big institutions that are running, and so more immigrants means more resources, because we got no more people we can make use of, and also it means we'll get less back talk, because more different kinds of people means that, you know, it's more fragmented, so, you know, we'll be able to make the choices, because the people won't be able to get together to question that. Whereas if you're at the in the middle range, or at the you'll say, well, gee, it's sort of nice to think of the country as kind of a mutual benefit society among the people who are members of it. You know, it's not for the benefit of the big institutions; it's for benefit of the people who are members of the society, and that gives you a very different outlook on immigration. Not to go down on a completely different tangent, but that seems an example of the difference in point of view between people who basically are in a position of running things, and that's how they look at it, and people who are part of the society and think of it as more of a cooperative effort among people with ties to each other.
It's interesting, James, the part about the immigration and why. I brought my children up to believe that always know that, you know, you're important to you, and that you're as good as the next person. They're not better than you. You're not better than them. I always remember that. But then I go back to my grandmother, who in the 40s and 50s, she cleaned homes. And when she passed away, only one person, who all those years that she cleaned their homes, only one person came to the funeral home. And it makes me think that back then there was this divide, and it sounds like the way you're talking, James, about immigration, is that's the way some people want it. Now, I won't say my children, because if I saw that, I'd tell them to remember where they came from. But is that happening again? Is that what I'm getting here?
Or maybe
it never stopped. I don't know.
I guess there's a couple of different things. I think in the older times, there were probably more local class divisions in America. There'd be some small town, and there'd be people like the best families, and the people who were different, like ranks in the small town. I think that's that kind of division has kind of declined somewhat. I think the division between the people at the very top, the Kerrys and the Bushes and the now the Obamas and has grown a great deal. And in fact, we still have inequalities. There's somewhat different inequalities. And then, of course, if you have large-scale immigration, you have further inequalities because, you have a lot of people who just aren't very well established and who come from places where, like in Mexico, there are great inequalities, and so the people who move here from there are used to that, and that makes some employers kind of like them, because they'll work hard and don't have to pay them too much. I think there's always inequalities. The particular inequalities that we have in America change over time, and I think that may be something of what you're mentioning. That it sounds like your mother, what sort of experience, like the traditional inequalities of, well, there are people who did domestic service, and then there are people employers employed them, and that was the distinction. And now we have other inequalities. It's continuing.
Well, James, I would like you to come back as a guest again, if you're willing.
I'd be very much like to. Actually, I should say that my son lives in New Hampshire now, so that the tie continues. So it's nice to be on the air in New Hampshire.
Well, you can remind him. He can go to W if he's not within the listening area, and we actually do cover quite an area.
Yeah, he's down in Concord.
Oh, he can hear it. He can be listening live right now.
I should have mentioned it to him, but there's a lot going on down here, so I didn't get in touch with him on the point.
Well, if he wants to hear it, he can go to WEZS.com and listen to the podcast later in the day. And it's hour by hour, so tell him to pick the fourth hour. And if he's anything like his father, he might enjoy hours one, two, and three.
It's been a good conversation with you guys. I think I've probably gone on at too much length because.
No, I don't think so. Gorell's got a big smile on his face.
A little bit more back and forth probably. You start off and people give their long rants, and then it gets more back and forth, and it gets more interesting for most people probably.
Well, with us, back and forth usually involves yelling at some point. So be careful what you ask for. yell.
That wakes people up,
Well, we're principled conservatives, which means that each one of us has our own idea on how the world should be.
Yeah, well, it's that makes it more interesting than having everybody say, you know, you're right, Bob. And
yeah, right. Yes,
you know,
yes.
So that's all very pleasant. But you got to, like, a little bit of more vigorous give and take every now and then.
Yeah, listen to the 9 o'clock hour.
Vigorous. Okay.
That's when we're talking about school choice with a caller. But James, we hope that you will come back, and I know how to get a hold of you. So, in the meantime, you can tell your son that he can actually listen to the program. But because if he missed it today, he can go to WEZS, Z as in zebra, S as in
right,
Sam,
yeah.
and go and visit the podcast. And he would want hour 4 to start with, so he could hear his father, who did a wonderful job of explaining his book, The Tyranny of Liberalism. And I look forward to the next time that you join us. And of course,
just get in touch, and it'll be a pleasure.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. If you travel up to Concord, maybe we can get you to come all the way. We're only 27 miles up the road.
Oh, okay. No, that sounds good. We keep intending to go up to visit him, but then there are things down here. But I think when the weather gets a bit warmer, we'll probably be.
All right. Then we'll see you.
We'll see you in July.
Okay. So I can really get at it.
There's two seasons in New Hampshire: winter and the 4th of July.
Okay.
You forgot road construction.
All right. I thank you, James.
Okay, good talk.
All right, Merry Christmas.
Okay, Merry Christmas. Bye now.
Bye. Okay, let's go to a break and then get back and do some lightning round stuff here or whatever. I was going to ask him about the George W. Bush quote, but I said, nah, I think Bill and Ken want a little of that. So we'll be right back. Have you been to Schofield's at Gunstock Inn yet? Chef Andy has the I Can't Believe It buffet on Friday and Saturday evenings, 5 till 9. If you like buffets, and I do, this is my idea of a buffet. Prime rib, veals, ribs, pork loin, duck breast, maple Dijon chicken, pesto chicken, haddock, shrimp, scallops, clams, mussels, lasagna, shells, Alfredo pasta, french fries, rice stuffing, onion rings, veggies, tenders. And that does not cover all of the items, but I had to leave a bit of a mystery, didn't I? I highly recommend the I Can't Believe It buffet Friday or Saturday evenings, 5 to 9. Say hi to Andy and tell him Neil Young sent you. Schofield's at Gunstock Inn, just a few minutes from Guilford Village and less than a mile west of Gunstock Ski Area. 293-2021. 293-2021.
There's a gem of a jewelry store in Belmont that offers a dazzling array of exquisite merchandise that's matched by unsurpassed service. Lakes Region Jewelers is your hometown full-service jeweler. The Bullerwell family, brother and sister team of Kelly and Bruce, continue the reputation for excellence that began over a quarter century ago by their father. Kelly is a graduate gemologist of the prestigious Gemological Institute of America, assuring you of the highest in ethical standards, along with an encyclopedic knowledge of gems. And Bruce provides on-site old-world style craftsmanship with the latest high-tech laser innovations for the finest jewelry repair in our area. At Lakes Region Jewelers, you'll discover wedding bands, engagement rings, anniversary bands, custom jewelry, and Lorenzo jewelry in silver and 18-karat gold. Nobody does color like Lorenzo, and nothing is more timely than the gift of a light-powered Echo Drive Citizen watch. For all your jewelry needs, your one-stop resource is Lakes Region Jewelers in the Belknap Mall and online at lakesregionjewelers.com.
Happy Jack's Pipe and Tobacco Shop, 71 Church Street in downtown Laconia, is dedicated to cigars, pipes, and tobacco. With over 500 pipes from around the world, with cigar lighters, cutters, and all the tools associated with enjoying a great cigar. In addition to a large selection of humidors, Happy Jack's suggests customizing a cigar sampler gift pack built for the smoker and the budget of the person purchasing. Remember, save 10% when you purchase cigars by the box. The Karagiannis family wishes you and your family a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Happy Jack's Pipe and Tobacco, 71 Church Street, Laconia, 528-4092.
We've been your local bank for 176 years, longer than any New Hampshire bank. Our mission is helping individuals and businesses succeed and enhancing the quality of life in New Hampshire. We provide local decision-making, personal service, and the latest technology. We strengthen our communities throughout New Hampshire through volunteerism and financial resources. We are living, working, and growing together. We know what New Hampshire is all about. We are Laconia Savings Bank. We are New Hampshire's local bank.
Okay, here we are again. Ken, Paul, Bill, me. No, don't bill me. Anyway, right now, let's see. I want to do a couple things here before we take the calls, because... here's George W. Bush on December 16th. I had to stop and think about where is this place in history, because right now it's in the President Bush says, I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system. Now, Ken and Bill, I know you have, you want to take out a couple of words, and you think it says more about his, who had that? Was it you, Bill?
That was me. You know, you talk about his place in history and his legacy, which, you know, will certainly be defined by historians now, you know, until he's long in the ground. But I think the best way to sum up the last 8 years and the Bush legacy is to subtract two words from that quote. You know, the original quote is, I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system. And if you subtract the phrase free market in both its instances in that quote, it pretty much sums up George W. Bush. I've abandoned principles to save the system. The system being Washington and the principles being conservative ones. And that's exactly what he's done throughout his entire tenure as President of the United States.
I mean, I saw that quote, the first thing that came to my mind was the famous quote from the Vietnam era, you know, it became necessary to destroy the village in order to save it. And it's that same thing. You just look at it and say, Mr. President, what the hell are you thinking? And of course, we know. I mean, he's destroyed the Republican Party, and he's hell-bent for leather on destroying market capitalism in this country as well. We're very much there. He's essentially, especially with the auto loan now, he's letting Obama and a more Democrat Congress, more beholden to the unions, make a decision that he could have made. Right here, right now, Chapter 11, just as the airlines went through it, and they're better for it. We got Southwest as a preeminent, certainly out of Manchester.
Certainly.
And nationally, I fly Southwest every time I can. He could have established a legacy there. We stood up for free market principles finally at the end. They filed for Chapter 11. They reorganized themselves and moved on.
Mm-hmm.
But no, what we're going to get is the same old UAW support plan. CEO support plan, and we've just shoveled $17 billion and about to be a heck of a lot more come next year into a system that can only fail. They don't produce cars that anyone wants. Everyone they sell, except for the trucks, which they're not selling a lot of right now, are sold at a loss. You can't keep that going. And instead of making them change, we've just given them money to keep going business as usual.
You know, both Ford and Toyota both sold 9.3 million cars last year. Ford did it at a multi-billion dollar loss. Toyota did it at a multi-billion dollar profit. Clearly, Ford is doing something wrong, and now they've just been rewarded with our tax dollars
not
and
Ford.
Our grandchildren's tax dollars.
I like Ford.
You're right.
I like Ford products, although they're much touted mid-sized car that's going to be the Honda Beater here, the next generation Fusion and Milan are made in Mexico, so we're not talking about American workers. But Ford didn't take the deal. They did something very unusual 2 years ago. They mortgaged everything, including the Blue Oval logo trademark.
Right.
Raised the capital that they needed, and they're on a track to probably, they've been pushing the date at which their operations will go into the black. They've been pushing it, but it's still there. They have something in place, a system that may actually work. GM and Chrysler absolutely do not. They're the ones that are needing this bailout. Ford may benefit because if GM and Chrysler do miraculously restructure their debt and restructure their union contracts, although they no longer have to because of the bailout, Ford may benefit.
But Ford has also asked for the possibility of a $9 billion loan from the government just in case that fails.
The government backing, loan guarantees,
right.
Yes.
So,
but they're not the ones on life support.
No, but if we look purely at the business model, and Ford can be indicative of all of Detroit, and we look at Toyota, whose cars are now built in the United States, and clearly the business model between Detroit and the non-union shops, one of them is making a profit, and it's not the unions.
I mean, you look at, I'm holding the Motor Trend Car of the Year, most recent magazine, and you look through all the contenders, and there are a couple contenders in here that are, well, the new Lincoln, the new Dodge Challenger is a contender, the Pontiac G8's a contender. They didn't make the finals.
No
American car produced anywhere in the world made it to the finals. Who are the finalists? Well, let's see, you got a couple of Japanese cars, you got another German, Japanese, Korean car.
A Korean car?
Yes,
which one?
The Hyundai Genesis? But the Lincoln, the new vaunted Lincoln Mark KX, whatever they're calling it now, it didn't make it. And of course, Jaguar. That's so an Indian car made it now. And
which used to be owned by Ford, by the way.
Yeah, and then, of course, well, we're following Detroit's following the well-worn path of the British automotive market.
That's right.
And, of course, a Japanese car won for Car of the Year, a car which, for less money, apparently not only outperforms the Corvette, but is much better built and longer-lasting and all the rest. So how much longer and how much more money are we going to put into a system that is demonstrably incapable of meeting market demand? But what are we going to do? We're going to let the government here, in the case of the federal government, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, have their way with Detroit. Detroit's going to start producing cars the Washington, D.C. way, all green, things that no one wants. It's eat your vegetables, except in this case, it's going to be, no, we're not. We're going to pay for it, and we're going to let them run down into the ground. And thank God that Japan and Germany are willing to produce cars in America using American workers, because it's going to come to the point where that's the only cars that are going to be produced here.
You know, if we're going to give these congressmen $4,700 more dollars a year, perhaps they could use that as a down payment on a new Chevy to get these pinheads out of debt. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but there are only a few hundred of them, and if we want to sell millions and millions, we got to cut that money from somewhere. But
we got to start it somehow.
It is amazing. You go to use a rental car, and you end up getting I had a Pontiac recently, or any of the rental cars, and you can tell. You get into a U.S. produced big, so-called big three, old three, or one of the Japanese rental cars, and they're made better.
Yeah.
The quality is better. The value is there.
That is so true, because I had rented I ended up with a, granted it's the lowest end of the line, a Chevy Aveo, and it was a piece of, it had 600 miles on it, and it was crap already.
And of course, it's a Suzuki rebadge, so even that car isn't made here. It's made in Japan.
Right.
But, well, it was a piece of crap, though, wherever it was made.
But I mean, we could do an entire program on the auto industry. What we've seen, GM has made every wrong mistake all the time. You know, we do a word association here. I say a car, and you tell me the GM equivalent in your mind to that. I say, you know, Honda Accord. What GM model springs to mind when I say Honda Accord? Price point, value, reliability, resale, all the rest. There isn't one. There hasn't been one for 30 years.
Honda the Cavalier Fit. Used to be.
Oh, Cavaliers were one of the worst. And what did GM do?
That would have been in the same.
No, because Hondas were better, more reliable, better price point.
No. I mean, but that
I'm talking about
been...
word association, synonyms. If you can think of a Honda Accord synonymously with a Cavalier, then there's something wrong.
I'm just saying that's what was competing. And not only did, I'm not saying.
But it wasn't competing. That's the point. And not only was the Cavalier a POS as a car, what did GM do? They rebadged it as a Cadillac
for a while. I know.
It's Cadillac Cimarron.
Yes.
Let's throw in leather seats.
That actually had a...
And a little
it was actually an equivalent for all five GM brands.
So not only did they produce a bad car at the low end of the spectrum, they upped it into their flagship brand. They wonder why Cadillac's had such problems over the years, as opposed to the Japanese model. And again, we're not talking rocket science. We're not talking secrets. These weren't business secrets.
Right.
These were open for the executives and the union leadership to see how their competition was doing it. They create a group like Lexus or Infiniti or Acura, and that quality worked its way down into into their less expensive products, making them better. GM built the bad thing and moved it up.
All right, couple quick ones here, because I want to Jose Campion and... I know they call him Nachos.
Mr. Ramos.
Ramos,
yeah. And it's like Ignatius, I think, is his real name.
Yeah, it is.
But anyway, I would like to see President Bush, at minimum, commute their sentences. These are the two border agents who shot a drug smuggler from Mexico here illegally with 700 pounds of marijuana in a van. They shot him in the bleep. And for that, one of Bush's cronies down in Texas put these two U.S. Border Patrol guards, agents in jail for 10 to 12 years. I would like him to let them out. They were doing their job. But let's move over to the ever popular and never to be forgotten, Johnny Walker Lynn, who, Ken Gorell put Johnny Walker Lynn together with Michael Spann.
Well, of course, the parents of the American jihadist, who at the age of 16 was allowed to travel overseas to Yemen and wonderful places like Pakistan and others to pursue his religious education as he became a Muslim. And, of course, he was captured on the battlefields of Afghanistan, fighting against the Americans, was put into a prison in Afghanistan, a holding spot until they figured out who he was. His parents are asking for a commutation of his 20-year prison sentence because, well, he was misguided. And the mother at least goes out on a limb and says, well, what he did was wrong. Well, what he did wasn't just wrong and anti-American and traitorous. The prison where he was held had an uprising. And we don't know exactly what role this man played in the uprising, but clearly he was trying to get out like everyone else was. And in the uprising, a true American hero was killed. And this man, was a Marine Corps veteran and an officer of the CIA. He was serving his country overseas, doing a job that most of us either could not do or would not want to do. And he was killed in this prison uprising. So here is the parents, or here are the parents of Johnny Walker Lind, trying to get him out. He only, because of a plea deal, was not charged in any connection with the killing of Agent Veteran Spann, which is why he only got 20 years. He needs to serve every one of those 20 years. He needs to think every day of those 20 years what he has done and the mistake he made, and he needs to be the example to all other misguided Utes out there about pursuing your religious education in terrorist havens of anti-American governments. And he should not get any sympathy, and certainly nothing from President Bush, because what happened to him in the U.S. justice system is just. And that needs to be the end of the story. And, of course, my fear is that President Bush will show compassion at Christmas time, which is what the parents are asking for.
For the wrong people.
And let Lind out, and Ramos and Campion will be in prison doing their 10 and 11-year sentences fully. And as I said, President Bush seems hell-bent for leather on destroying not only the GOP and market capitalism, but our sense of ourselves. And I will never understand it. I guess the apple didn't fall far enough from that tree. The voodoo economics of his father, never believing in Reagan, despite being his VP, his pledge to never raise taxes, and then doing so, good riddance to the Bushes. I hope we never see them again.
Yeah, it's called punishment for a reason, and this Johnny Walker Lind deserves to. You're right, serve every one of those 20 years, and unfortunately, knowing George Bush and the fact that he's more willing to pardon a Thanksgiving turkey before he is Ramos and Campion, I think that we know all about him we need to know. I think there's actually no hope that before January 20th he's going to issue a commutation or a pardon for them, and it angers me to no end. I've called the White House, numerous times over this, and the comment line, which everybody should have, taped next to their phone, which is 202-456-1111. I don't think Bush cares. I think Bush is just happy to go along doing his own thing, and I think that's the mindset he's had for a while. It benefited us for a time, and now that he's clearly, over the last 4 years, gotten further and further away from principle.
When you're not tethered to principle.
Right.
And people have got to remember Ramos and Campion, and they got to remember the name of Johnny Michael Spann, who at the age of 32 was taken away from us, and we are, as a nation, worse off for his loss. As a nation, we are better off that people like John Walker Lynn do their time.
Yeah. Looks like we got about a minute left.
A minute. Bill says a minute. Poor Paul. He's sitting all this and they don't let me talk anymore.
Trying to catch his breath from the 9:30 time frame. He's yelling at us.
I'm listening.
Anyway, as we leave, this is actually the last program for this year because we will return on January 3rd. Because I think New Year's Eve and New Year's Day are probably not holidays you really want to spend a whole lot of time with the family like Christmas is, and there's a reason for Christmas. How am I doing, Bill?
In about 20 seconds.
So anyway, I'd like to take about 29 seconds to talk about blessings, but I don't have that many. So I will just say that it's the people around me are blessings to me because you come in here and travel way up here to put up with us. So Merry Christmas to
Merry
everyone.
Christmas. Merry Christmas.
And we're off about now, aren't we, Bill?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We'll see you January 3rd.